Today on Renewing Your Mind, Evangelicalism. Are we all together? Thirty or 40 years ago, the term evangelical meant something. Those who embraced that label came from a variety of Protestant denominations. They had a high view of the authority of Scripture, the central place of Christ's atoning work on the cross, and the necessity of the new birth in Christ. Evangelical became sort of an umbrella term that bunches conservative Christians together. But are we all together? Welcome to the Saturday edition of Renewing Your Mind and Dr. Robert Godfrey's Survey of Church History. Today, Dr. Godfrey will explore how and why evangelicalism is no longer a helpful term.
We've been looking, as we've gone along, at some of the huge issues that have been confronting the church in our time. And in this penultimate lecture, I want to return closer to home to look at the subject of evangelicalism. Now, we've used the word evangelical any number of times in these lectures, and often I've allowed it to stand just as a kind of synonym for conservative Protestantism. But I think it's very appropriate as we think about the 20th century and we think about the context in which we find ourselves in North America in the 21st century, I want to suggest that we need to look more carefully, more precisely at the subject of evangelicalism and ask, what exactly is evangelicalism? The British scholar D.W. Bebbington suggested that evangelicalism essentially has 4 points. It's disappointing, but we have to live with it. He suggested, first of all, that it is characteristic of evangelicalism that they are committed to the Bible. They're committed to the authority of the Bible, they're committed to the distribution of the Bible, and they're committed to the teaching of the Bible. And that certainly would be true and helpful and key to any historic sense of the word evangelical. Secondly, he said, evangelicals are cross-centered. When it comes to theology, they want to focus on Jesus and on his saving work on the cross. That's at the very heart of what they are, of what they talk about, of the message that they need to get across to people. It is a cross-centered theology. Thirdly, he says evangelicals are very concerned about conversion. From the Bible, they focus on the cross, and the message of the cross should lead to changed hearts and changed lives. And that's a great passion of evangelicals, to see conversions, to see people brought to faith, to see people brought out of darkness into life. That is a characteristic and essential element of evangelicalism. And fourthly, he says, characteristic of evangelicals is a kind of activism. They are at work. They want to be busy about advancing the cause of Christ as they see it. They're busy in evangelism, both corporate kinds of evangelism and individual kinds of evangelism. They're busy in missions. They're busy in moral reform and voluntary cooperation and educational activities. There is a busyness, an activity about evangelicalism, and that is essential to who they are and how they ought to be understood. Others have suggested that to those four elements, a fifth might be added. And that would be that evangelicalism has displayed a remarkable adaptability to the cultures in which it has found itself. So when people look at evangelicalism in the late 18th and on into the 19th century, they often find a very rational spirit to evangelicalism as it seeks to speak to a rather rational age. And now some have suggested in the latter part of the 20th century, when Western culture seems to become less rational, perhaps more irrational, or at least more feeling-oriented, evangelicalism too has become more feeling-oriented. And so that would suggest there is an adaptability to evangelicalism that is crucial to its character. Now, if that's something of the character of evangelicalism, then we might ask, What exactly is its function in the religious life of America? Evangelicalism would answer that by saying, well, evangelicalism is a uniting movement to bring Protestants together. And the reason that we emphasize these four or five elements as central is it's because those are the things that unite all conservative Protestants. And therefore, evangelicals would say evangelicalism is really a kind of umbrella that wants to have under its umbrella whatever kind of Protestant you are, as long as you're Bible-believing, cross-centered, conversion-oriented, and active. And so if you're a Methodist, you're welcome under the evangelical umbrella. If you're a Baptist, you're welcome under the evangelical umbrella. If you're a Presbyterian, you're welcome under the evangelical umbrella. If you're a Lutheran, you're welcome under the evangelical umbrella. And therefore, evangelicals pretty much recognize that there is a kind of minimalism to what their core values are. In other words, evangelicals often want to ask, what are the minimal number of essential things that we have to believe to be faithful Protestant Christians and yet not reject other Protestant Christians? And so there's a constant kind of push towards this question. What are the basics? What are the minimal? What are the defining, underlying, foundational values so that we can keep this umbrella as big as legitimate to unite various Protestants? And it's understandable that those are the ways evangelicals understand themselves and the way evangelicals want other Protestants to understand evangelicalism. I would like to dissent from that. And I would like to say to you, in some ways, I do not consider myself an evangelical. Now, I don't want you to be too shocked. I certainly believe in the Bible, and I believe in the cross, and I believe in conversion, and I believe in activism. In that sense, if certain people ask me in certain circumstances, are you an evangelical? You know, if I was on the Today Show and they said, are you an evangelical? I'm almost certainly going to say yes. But amongst a more informed crowd, a brilliant group like this, I really want to say I'm not an evangelical. Now, why do I want to say that? Is it just because I'm contrary by nature? That could be. But I think, for all that evangelicalism wants to say it's a uniting umbrella, and that's true up to a point, it is also a movement that says, in the interests of unity, you Presbyterians, stop talking about infant baptism. And you Baptists, stop making a big deal about believers' baptism. And you Lutherans, stop talking about the Lord's Supper the way you talk about it, in your distinctive way. That's why conservative Lutherans in America have almost always said to the evangelicals, we're not one with you. Because when you come up with your minimal list, sacraments aren't on it. And we're not interested in any minimal definition of Christianity that doesn't have sacraments on it, say the Lutherans. Now, do you begin to see what I'm trying to get at? Probably not yet, because I've been very clear. I think evangelicalism is not an umbrella unitive phenomenon. I think evangelicalism is, in fact, its own distinct brand of Protestant Christianity. And when I say that, I don't mean to be insulting to evangelicals. I don't mean to be demeaning evangelicals. But none of us have any trouble understanding that a Pentecostal is not a Lutheran. And a Lutheran is not Reformed. So why should it be so difficult for us to say, just as there are Pentecostals and there are Lutherans, and there are Reformed, so there are evangelicals. And we can be friends. We share a number of beliefs in common. We can cooperate on certain endeavors. But being Reformed is a thing with its own integrity that can't be reduced to just 4 points. We need 5. In fact, we actually need more. I would want to say that in a certain sense, one could say that Reformed Christianity is inherently maximalist. Now, by that I mean, Reformed Christianity always is struggling to see what's the fullness that we can find in the Bible. We want to know everything that's in the Bible. It's interesting that evangelicals who are so passionate about the Great Commission, and they've done much to carry out the Great Commission, forget that an essential part of the Great Commission is Jesus saying, "Teach them all that I have commanded you." He doesn't say, "Teach them the 4 basic things I've commanded you and let the rest go." And of course, evangelicals aren't really saying that either. But you see, there is a different impulse in evangelicalism that wants to think about the minimum to unite as many people as possible, and the Reformed who want to think about the maximum, and I think we'd say in defense of ourselves, to try to be as faithful as possible. And I don't say that to be proud, but if a Lutheran says, you know, if I can't have my Lutheran doctrine of the sacraments, I don't think I really have Lutheranism anymore. I've given it up. I can't do that. It would be a violation of the integrity of my understanding of the Bible and my commitments. And I think we Reformed ought to sort of feel the same. We can cooperate with evangelicals, we can appreciate evangelicals, but I think we can also say to evangelicals, you know, I'm Reformed and not a Lutheran because I think the Reformed are right on the issues where Reformed and Lutherans differ. I know Lutherans don't agree with me on that. Some of my best friends are Lutherans, and we've had wonderful discussions. Whenever I talk to a Lutheran, I feel like I learn lots of things that I haven't known before, but I'm not persuaded to be a Lutheran. So I don't hate them. I can appreciate them. I certainly see them as brothers and sisters in Christ, but I'm different. And I feel the same about evangelicalism. And just as I'd say to a Lutheran, you know, I think on these points, you're not really understanding the scriptures, and that leads to certain weaknesses in your religious life. And as I'd say to Pentecostals, I've had Pentecostal friends. I was interviewed on Sister McPherson's radio station, and they kind of liked me, the husband and wife ministerial team that interviewed me. But if I had had a chance for a prolonged conversation with them, yeah, I just said, you know, there are certain places where I think you misread the Bible, and it leads to certain weaknesses in your tradition. And I would want to say as a Reformed person the same thing to the evangelicals. You have many strengths, but I think you've missed certain things about the Bible, and I think it's led to certain weaknesses in your tradition. There may be areas where you're stronger than my Reformed tradition. You've maybe done more in evangelism and missions in the last century than we've always done. Of course, we're a pretty small group. We're barely surviving. We're kind of on life support, you know, as Reformed people. But sure, we can be complimentary to the evangelicals. But I want to say to them, your movement, precisely because of its minimalism, has proven to be theologically unstable. Now, I don't say that in any sort of mean way. I rejoice that there are lots of stable evangelicals. But if you look at the movement as a whole, as we've been doing, late 19th, early 20th century, profound theological instability. And what do we see today? Exactly the same thing in evangelicalism. Because they're minimalistic, because they're culturally adaptable, because they're so concerned about evangelism, they're constantly asking, well, can we eliminate that so we can avoid giving offense? And the danger is you've eliminated so much and nature abhors a vacuum, all kinds of things begin to creep back in. I'm amazed how many evangelicals have been sympathetic to elements of the charismatic movement. It's hard to find in America today, there are exceptions, but it's hard to find in America today an evangelical church that doesn't worship like the Pentecostals did in the 20s. Now, that doesn't prove who's right and who's wrong. That will not convince you all to become psalm singers, as you really should. But it's a simple fact that evangelicals have adopted themselves to what once were Pentecostal forms of worship. Or evangelicals have embraced tradition as a way of stabilizing their movement. So there are a handful of evangelical churches that look more like Anglican churches. That's not the worst thing in the world. But you see, there's a need to find something kind of outside the essentials of the movement itself to supplement it. And if the supplementing of the Bible doesn't turn to the Spirit, as the Pentecostals did, or to tradition, as various groups have done, there's a very great danger that they will turn to reason. And that's where I think we see some serious slippage in various parts of the evangelical world today. Well, you know, let's not offend people by banging the table about biblical inerrancy. You don't give away that much if you grant that the Bible has some mistakes in it and some problems in it. It doesn't affect the central core message. Well, it does over time. And that's what we're kind of facing today. Now, B.B. Warfield, the great Princeton theologian, said, well, now, when we think about truth, we ought to think about it this way. There's Catholic truth. By that, Warfield meant the doctrine of the Trinity, the doctrine of Christology. Those are things that Protestants, Catholics, Greek Orthodox all hold together. And then he said, added to that Catholic truth of the Trinity, Christology, is evangelical truth, by which Warfield meant some of the great discoveries of the Reformation, essential Protestant truths. And then he said, on top of that are added some distinctive Reformed truths. And Warfield said, well, the best of people have all of those things. And I think there's a profound truth there. That kind of distinction can be made, can be helpfully made, and we end up with what looks like almost a nice birthday cake there. Now, the danger of the birthday cake approach, I don't think this is what Warfield meant, but the danger of this approach is that Reformed theology seems just like the frosting on the cake. You have most of the cake without it, and it just adds, if you have a sweet tooth like me, the essential thing, but nonetheless, it just adds a little frosting on top. And it kind of reinforces then the evangelical notion that if we want to be unified and be active, let's leave out the Reformed distinctives and just be together as evangelicals. And that's why I don't think this diagram, I don't think it's what Warfield intended, but I don't think this diagram ultimately is very helpful. I think instead we could think of it more like this, like circles. There's an evangelical circle and there's a Reformed circle because we're different traditions. Now, we have certain things in common, certain things where we overlap, certain things that we believe together. But it's also true that the integrity of our movement requires that we say these things are not unimportant just because the evangelicals don't share them. And that's the kind of implication. If you're being reformed, I would like to suggest that one of the things you believe is in election. If you're not sure about that, get R.C. Sproul's book, Chosen by God. But We would say, as Reformed people, that election is not just a little frosting on the cake. That election is really foundational. It is essential. It is the bulwark of being saved by grace alone. And if we're asked to be quiet about elections so we won't disturb the evangelical unity, we ought to say, I can't do that, because the Bible's not quiet about election. Have you ever met somebody who knew the Bible pretty well and had not been reformed and then became reformed? And they come to you and they say, predestination's all over the Bible. How did I never see it before? That's happened to me over and over again. And it's true, isn't it? You know, Paul in Ephesians 1 talks about election. And he says that it's one of the great spiritual blessings for the church. It isn't our dirty little secret that we only talk about at Sunday night when we finally get to Romans 9 and go just as fast as we can to avoid spending too much time on it. It's glorious. It's foundational. It's reassuring. If the doctrine of election that you have doesn't reassure you and comfort you in your faith, you haven't understood the biblical doctrine of election. We don't have time to go into that now. R.C. does in his book, Chosen by God. Get that book. But you see the point I'm trying to make. There's a structural integrity to Reformed theology that needs to be maintained as a whole. In order to do that, I think we as Reformed people have to say, I'm Reformed. I'm not an evangelical. Now, I try not to be nasty when I say that. I try not to be too triumphalistic. Reformed people can be kind of triumphalistic. Nah, 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 I'm right and you're wrong. We don't want to be like that. But we wanted to say, we're so passionate about the Great Commission, we really want to teach everything that Jesus taught us. And Jesus in John 6 taught election. And so I think it's crucial to the future of Reformed Christianity in America and around the world that we come to a self-consciousness, a clarity about being distinct. And we need that because it's hard to be Reformed in America. Because the dominant Protestant religious ethos in America is evangelical. And therefore, that evangelical spirit is constantly seeping in to Reformed hearts and Reformed churches. Now, I don't want to get into the issue of psalms and hymns, but it was evangelical influences that brought hymns into Presbyterian and Dutch Reformed churches that had always been psalm singing. Now, whether that's good or bad is not my point. The point is, it didn't come from the soul of Reformed people themselves. It came largely from evangelical influence. If you're in a Reformed church where there's a praise band, that didn't come from Reformed influences. It didn't come immediately from Pentecostal influences. It came through the evangelical influences. Now, again, we're going to talk next time a little more about these things. And I understand that Reformed is not such a simple concept either. We're going to talk about what it means to be Reformed next time in the ultimate lecture. But for this lecture, the great point I wanted to make is to see that evangelicalism mustn't be allowed to define what Reformed means and can talk about. They have every right to be what they want to be. It's a free country. But Reformed Christianity has a right to be what it is as it follows the Scriptures.
That's Dr. Robert Godfrey and a message titled Doctrinal Distinctives. It's from his series, A Survey of Church History. And you're listening to Renewing Your Mind on this Saturday. This is a practical and informative study of the triumphs and tragedies of the church. It showcases God's redemptive work over the past 2,000 years. And we'd like to send you this 73-part 12 DVD set Simply give a gift of any amount to Ligonier Ministries, and we'll get it out to you right away. You can give your gift online and make your request at renewingyourmind.org, or you can call us, and one of my colleagues here at Ligonier Ministries will be happy to take your request. Our number is 800-435-4343. You know, as we study church history, we are reminded of what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 16, that the gates of hell would not prevail against his church. In this series by Dr. Godfrey, he gives us a glimpse of how that promise has been fulfilled. So again, request a survey of church history by Dr. Robert Godfrey. Our web address again is renewingyourmind.org, and our phone number is 800-435-4343. Well, next week on Renewing Your Mind, Dr. Godfrey will conclude his series by evaluating the church in the 21st century, highlighting the essentials of Reformed Christianity. We hope you'll join us next week.